The COVID-19 pandemic has completely upended life for people all across the world. The massive changes to daily routine and all the uncertainty of the pandemic are stressful for everyone, but it's certainly changing mental health as well. Dr. Arash Javanbakht is director of the Stress, Trauma, and Anxiety Research Clinic at Wayne State University's Department of Psychiatry. Dr. Javanbakht, welcome to Stateside.
It's a pleasure.
We're also speaking with Allison Miller. She's a developmental psychologist and associate professor at the School of Public Health with the University of Michigan. Allison Miller, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, I just want to ask how you both are doing. Allison, do you want to start?
Sure. Well, I'm a parent, so it's definitely changing my life in that way with kids being home and trying to get everything done from home. So on a personal note, certainly that's been a change. Also, you know, just the way that everybody has been coping with these massive changes has been impressive to me when I've been working with colleagues and the families that we see in our research studies. Everybody's kind of pulled together in a way that I think has been supportive interpersonally, even though we're physically distanced. But it's been hard.
Arash, how about you? What's your situation?
Well, actually, a couple of weeks before having to stay home, I came back from Paris, so I had to stay at home. So I have been sitting at home for longer, and maybe I had more time to cope with it. From a work perspective, well, I used to do telemedicine, and research a lot of times is flexible, so it has not been too much of coping. But on the other hand, I'm a very social person, and a lot of my life was social interactions, whether it was at the gym or interacting with friends at the coffee shop or hanging out, spending time together. That is cut out, and it has been a challenge to cope with that, and also trying to keep the routines of life, including staying active and healthy, has been a challenge that I've been working on and getting better.
No doubt. Allison, your work studies risk and resiliency in children and families. Short of, I guess, a wartime situation, can you imagine a more challenging time for the family dynamic than this?
Not really, no. It's really been the focus of a lot of the people I've been speaking with, colleagues, friends, just how to manage all of these new situations that we're finding ourselves in. Certainly with families who are lucky enough for the parents to be able to work at home, it's been a challenge just in terms of meeting everybody's needs, having everybody in the same space when they're used to being out and doing different activities in their lives. Certainly, kids of different ages present different challenges for family dynamics, and I've been talking about that as well with, again, friends and colleagues who have kids of different ages.
Arash, what's been most striking to you about stresses on patients coming to the clinic?
Well, there are multiple stressors that people are dealing with at this time. And actually, a lot of factors that contribute to stress and trauma and anxiety in general are in the what's happening to us right now. One is the transition. Transition is always stressful. And everybody is going through multiple transitions, from changes in the work style, having to be at home, spending time with the kids, not being able to do a lot of things they used to do. And this all happened very suddenly. We didn't have time to transition. It was not like, okay, now we're going to transition over a course of 2 months to working from home. So that was stressful. Besides, there's the factor of uncertainty, which is always adding to the stress and pressure of what we deal with, where here we have the ultimate example. We don't know who has it, who doesn't have it. We are not very clear about how this pathogen works and for how long are we going to be here and what is the outcome. And then there's the lack of control that we have over this situation, which is basically any time we are in a stressful situation that we have not much control over, we are even more stressed. And now the only control here we have is to sit at home. And among the patients, to go back to your questions, Well, I see the same stress, especially people. I work with anxious people, anxious and traumatized people, and a person who is anxious always has a lower threshold of detecting something dangerous, or they may overshoot for what is scary. And so they're more stressed. They may be anticipating the danger a little bit more than the facts tell us. And at the same time, they have been going through all these transitions. A lot of them are financial restraints. A lot of them have to spend more time with family, which can be good, which can be stressful, or spending time with the kids, homeschooling, stress of the work transition, having to work in a different setting. Not only that, but also for a lot of people, because of these restrictions, the work duties have changed. So they have to learn new skills and new ways of dealing with it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm also exposed to creative ways that they have found to deal with this stress. For instance, just one example that I learned myself was a patient told me, well, to stay active, we now have, my and my husband have commute time, which means in the morning and late in the afternoon, the time that we were supposed to be commuting to work, we now go for a walk every day.
Nice. This moment is not just an individual feeling of anxiety. There's, as you say, the much bigger worldwide anxieties that is in some ways contagious itself. I have found myself wondering which is more contagious, the new coronavirus, or the fear that has been sweeping over people and sometimes even reshaping the behaviors of people who are lucky enough to be healthy right now. What do you say to people about keeping that under control? I don't know. Arash, would you like to start?
Yeah, sure. So this is kind of a paradox. In some sense, when the danger and threat is not right next door and it's not right here, we underreact, which was what we saw in the basically international response to the pandemic and lack of preparedness, as if when it is happening in China or in Europe or in the future, and it's not immediate enough to us, we are not ready to emotionally react to it and be prepared. And lack of preparedness can be seen across the Western world. But when it is here, yes, and it can be more stressful, especially when people don't know the facts, don't know where to get the facts, or they are exposed to too much data, which they cannot parse out what they can trust and what they cannot. You get data on the social media from friends, from family, from relatives, all these like weird theories about the issue, and then it comes to the media.
Yeah,
I always say that American cable news are like disaster pornographers. Basically, there's always an emotional intensity to the story told. And kudos to NPR. I tell my patients, listen to BBC or NPR, because do you just get exposed to the facts?
I just need to say, we do encourage people, if they need to also turn off sometimes if their anxiety level is getting out of control. It can happen
even
with the most moderated tone.
Exactly. And I tell people that limit your exposure to news. Just get what you want to know. You need to know. Don't get obsessed with it. At least give yourself several hours of break from the news, not to be exposed to it.
Yeah.
These are some ways of like know the facts from the real sources, from the reliable sources, but then don't get over obsessed over checking every half hour how many people got infected and how many people died.
Allison, what are you telling parents right now about anxiety?
Yeah, I would echo much of what Arash was saying in terms of keeping kind of on a news diet, know the facts, you get the facts from reputable sources and on a regular basis. Also just encouraging parents to be aware that they'll hear about something big, like school closing, for example, and then they can find out more information at that point. I think an important thing also for parents to realize is that how much our stress kind of can carry over to our kids and in our parenting. And so we know from a lot of research prior that when parents are stressed, risks to children go up because it's harder to parent in a sensitive and effective way. And so one of the things that I've been trying to talk with parents about is taking some time to manage your own responses to the pandemic. And that can be things like taking a walk outside while we still can do that, just taking a moment for yourself to kind of de-stress and give yourself a break. Also to be kind to yourself and sort of forgiving of parenting maybe goals that you have under normal circumstances that you might let sort of slide during these circumstances. So a classic example would be sort of phone use, especially with teens. Phone use can certainly be something that parents really try to moderate. And right now, it's getting harder to do that because that's a primary way of socially connecting for teens and really for all of us. So that might be an area where parents can struggle because normally you might set more rules around phone use, but right now it feels perhaps more difficult to do so.
Right.
Still important to do so and to try to do routines that allow for alternate activities, but just certain areas of parenting might be really hard to hold on to while we're all stressed and managing our own stress.
We're in a situation right now where there are so many people grieving the loss of loved ones and who maybe haven't been able to do so in the ways that their families traditionally would have marked such an event. What do you think it's going to mean to have so many people going through the process of grief at the same time, Allison?
Well, I think it is really important to realize that grief and loss have many stages and take time to cope with, and that the trauma that we're feeling as individuals as well as communities will unfortunately be long lasting in all likelihood in terms of coping. And so I think that one thing that's really important is thinking about, again, being kind of kind to yourself and being able to acknowledge your feelings, but manage, try not to let them get the best of you in terms of, I'm not being very articulate here, but in terms of engaging with other positive things in life. I think that what we know about grief, loss, and trauma, and certainly Arash can speak to this as well, but it's important to reach out and connect with others and also to be able to process those feelings, but it might be overwhelming to do so at the time, especially when we don't have our resources that we usually have, like physical contact with a family member, being even able to see a family member in the hospital or hold funerals or memorial services in the way that we would typically do and in ways that are healing for trauma and grief and loss.
When we come back, we'll continue my conversation about mental health during distancing with Dr. Arash Javanbacht and psychologist Allison Miller. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. As we all try to come to terms with the anxiety and fear of physical distancing, we're talking today with two mental health professionals, Dr. Arash Javanbacht, Director of Stress, Trauma, and Anxiety, Director of the Stress, Trauma, and Anxiety Research Clinic at Wayne State, and University of Michigan School of Public Health psychologist Allison Miller. Arash, healthcare workers are under extraordinary stress right now. I mean, they are the ones who may be there with people in their final minutes and hours. They're doing the best job they can, sometimes with limited supplies. What are the lasting impacts of that kind of trauma?
Actually, this morning we had a team meeting discussing about possibility of looking at how this is impacting the healthcare workers, because not only they are enduring all the stressors that we mentioned other people are going through, but also now they have to deal with extraordinary levels of expectations from them at work, some of them not even fully prepared for this. An ER doctor may be prepared for this, but other physicians or other staff or nurses who were working in other, let's say, dermatology, other fields now are being called to help because there's not enough staffing. So there are multiple ways that they are stressed. One is fear of, like, in reality, the fear of what may happen to myself. And as a result and consequence, my family. There are a lot of doctors who are now staying in their garages or in their basements because they don't want to be, or nurses, they don't want to be interacting with their family and putting them at risk. And then another thing, which actually any first responder, including the healthcare workers, is important for them, is the sense of control that I can do something. My job is to help. And now they are kind of helpless because we don't have clear treatments. We don't know what are the best ways of helping these people. And when it comes to a lot of people who end up dying, that is also very painful. Every time a physician or a healthcare worker loses a patient, they are stressed. So I imagine they are under intense amount of stress, different ways of thinking and feeling about it, from guilt, from frustration, from feeling of desperation. And then consequently, I would expect symptoms of trauma coming out and depression, anxiety, which we have seen in other groups, including first responders and medical workers who have been involved in natural disasters in the past. There's also some data coming out of China that people are burned out and stressed.
What would you tell hospitals right now about mitigating some of the stress that healthcare workers are feeling?
Well, I would actually have some ideas about in general how to deal with the stress for everybody, which could be used by healthcare workers, but then on top of that would be what healthcare workers would do separately. I mean, one is that we did talk about exposure to news and reducing that exposure to the minimum required, but also keeping our routines as much as we can. In general, like, we used to go to the bed at the same time, wake up at the same time, have good meal approaches, like routine of when we had every meal and not eating all day long because we are next to the pantry, trying to keep those routines or establishing them. I know it is difficult, but trying to have them. And the other part is staying physically active for everybody, I suggest that, because we know a lot about how regular exercise, especially regular cardio workout, not only is a way to vent, but also reduces vulnerability to anxiety, depression, boosts the immune system, and helps a lot. And it can also be a bonding way when we are stuck at home. When it comes to that, venting also and discussing and talking and to other people can be very helpful. I don't like the term physical distancing. I'm sorry, mm-hmm. I don't like the term social distancing. I despise it.
Why?
I would love people call it physical distancing because we can, you and I are now having a social communication while we are physically distant. We can be physically distant and safe, but not be asocial. The idea of socially distancing from other people, not being connected to others, is scary to us. We are social creatures. We have million ways of connecting to other people without being in a physical space with them. There are people who are doing happy hours and brunches and exercise and workout, everything on these video chats and calling friends, like our phones, our smartphones, other than the ability to use Instagram, surprisingly have ability to call people and talk to them. So there are ways to stay connected. And when it comes to the healthcare workers specifically, they need the mental health right now. They need the mental health care available to them. Of course, everybody has talked about need for having like a reasonable hours of work. You cannot have someone work for, like, I don't know, 100 hours a week. But sometimes this is a crisis situation. They have to having the PPEs for them, having them feel safe and having them feel in control. All the news that is coming at them that, well, tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, you may not have your PPEs to deal with this crisis. Well, these are very stressful to these people because they also worry about their own health and the health of their families.
Yeah. Allison Miller, one of the real conundrums of this is that normally in times of stress, some of the things that we do to feel better is to, you know, go into social places, meet up with our friends or spend time with our family. Arash talked about some of the physical things, you know, some vigorous physical exercise that might be an option. Is there anything that you are talking to folks about maybe if you're less active or if you've got physical limitations on what you can do, things that might be essential to sort of counteract some of the effects of social distancing right now? physical distancing right now.
Physical distancing, right. I agree with the use of the term physical distancing as well. There are many different social ways to engage that are virtual. I've certainly seen and participated in things like Zoom connections with friends and maybe treating this time as an opportunity to reach out and connect with friends or loved ones that you may not connect with on a daily basis in one's regular life. And so I think that that type of social connection is very important, and perhaps even building it in on a regular basis into your daily routine might become an important thing to do. Another thing that I've thought about, it's not vigorous physical activity necessarily, but if we can go outside, if we can be in a little bit of nature, we also know that from research, looking at nature and experiencing nature can be calming to the biological stress system. And so any opportunity, especially as the weather gets nicer, just to go outside and take a slow walk, if that's possible, is a helpful thing to do. And again, building it into your routine so that you can think of it as a restorative activity. I guess the other thing is to, if one has the bandwidth, think about kind of longer term projects that you might want to engage in and books you've not read and that kind of thing, sort of taking stock of what might be other activities to engage in that are not necessarily social but could connect you with parts of yourself that are less stressed than dealing with the news of the pandemic in the moment.
So in line with what Allison mentioned, there have been a lot of things that we always thought we wanted to do if we had the time. Well, now there is the time. And I suggest, well, there are some of them are chores, but it's important to have some hobbies or fun activities, especially kind of creative, productive ones, because for a lot of us, the level of productivity and the meaning we get from that is reduced. And one other activity, which is actually related to nature as well, it's the spring. And there's one activity that we can do, which is productive, which is creative, which is healthy, which includes physical distancing and has some physical activity to it, which is gardening. It's a great time to start doing that yard work and the gardening projects.
Right. Absolutely. And related to gardening, there's certainly cooking, right? So learning new things that one can cook, and especially if there are sort of limited ingredients, it might be time to be creative or challenge yourself with regard to preparing meals every day. And the other thing that I think that is important to think about is engaging in some sort of reflective or mindfulness relaxation type practices that can be really soothing and calming, again, to our biological stress systems. And again, probably many of us have apps on our phone that maybe, you know, we haven't used, but we downloaded at some point. Now might be a time to engage with those apps, like a yoga app or a, you know, other mindful relaxation focused app.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Allison Miller. She's a developmental psychologist and associate professor with the School of Public Health at the U of M. And we're also speaking with Dr. Arash Javanbacht. He's director of the Stress, Trauma, and Anxiety Research Clinic at Wayne State. Some communities are hit harder by this than others. Detroit has become the epicenter of the state's outbreak. Some of the data we've seen recently shows that 40% of the people who died from COVID-19 so far in Michigan were African-American people. What does that do to the mental health, not just of individuals, but of an entire community? Allison, do you have some thoughts?
Absolutely. I think that sometimes when these tragedies happen at a community level, it's very hard to reestablish trust in the bigger systems that might be perceived to have contributed to this community-level trauma. Neighborhoods that are being really hit hard right now in this pandemic, especially in Detroit, are often already kind of living at the margins or have families in them that are living at the margins that are already depending on lots of social services just to get by. So things like food, shelter, transportation, childcare, medical care, mental health care. A lot of these services are very important for these families, and often they're not accessed. And as we were talking about earlier, this has been such a rapid transition that not everybody has gotten hooked up with the services that might be helpful for managing this community level stress and trauma quite yet. So that's something I think we really need to think about and make sure that our services remain in place and that we have in some way outreach to families who really need them, who are being really hit hard by this pandemic at a community level.
Arash, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, the African American community is traditionally underserved by professional mental health for a myriad of reasons.
This is a community that had, it's not like everything was good until now and then this happened. No, it's just one another step added to the cumulative trauma and stress, whether it's financial, whether it's housing, whether it's other safety-related issues and healthcare-related issues, as well as physical health and physical illnesses, which can worsen the situation. The other aspect is that the African-American families are very integrated and they're very, very closely connected, and loss of one member of a group and a family is very painful and hurtful to them. In terms of availability of mental health services, I don't have data that would suggest, like, when you compare at the same level of socioeconomic situation, one group of people has less or more access. Well, I work at Wayne State University in Detroit, and majority of the patients I serve there are African-American patients. And what I can see, I cannot answer your question directly, but what I can see is the resilience in this population. I work with the poorest of the poor, and despite all the difficulties, whether it's trauma or financial or housing or relationship issues that they have been dealing with, they are so resilient and so responsive to care and treatment that is provided. I really enjoy working with this population.
Yeah. Can you both think ahead perhaps to the weeks from now, the months from now, and I guess we should say the years from now, as we recover from what's happening, what are some of the things that public health officials or maybe you'd like leaders to think about when it comes to dealing with the fallout of the mental health epidemic related to COVID?
Well, I think we can acknowledge we are going to have a lot of financial hardship going forward. And again, it's families who have been living at the margins already or who are maybe under-resourced who are hit the hardest. But I think everybody will be hit at some level. And what we know from just decades of research is that, you know, living in poverty is a real risk factor for child development. And what we also know is that early childhood experiences can be very formative for later life outcomes. And so one of the things that we really need to make sure we have in place is that social safety net. It's already a bit frayed, quite a bit frayed in many cases, but we need to make sure that we have supports in place for the many, many families who will need to be accessing them. The other thing to think about, certainly now as schools have just closed down for the year, is that children who are in school settings or other sort of child care settings are exposed to teachers and other caregivers who may be able to and often do pick up on things like child maltreatment that may be happening in the family. And so without children going out into these other environments or other contexts, we kind of lose a little bit of our ability to prevent some of these behaviors from happening. And so that's something also to think about from a child welfare perspective. How are we going to keep our eyes on our kids in our communities in a helpful way that can prevent any negative outcomes of the stressors that families may be facing in these hard times as we go forward?
Arash, what are your priorities when you think about trying to help everyone heal from this?
So we would need a slow transition back to normal life because of all the issues that we mentioned that were stressful for us to get to this stage. Then going back to full force to normal life is going to be stressful. there will continue to be fears of what if it comes back to us. People who were traumatized by it, or they're affected, or they lost someone to it, will be scared of it. The kids, Allison noted, trauma and stress during childhood may have long-lasting effects. Even adults who went through childhood stress and trauma may have different physical illnesses more than others and be prone to trauma and PTSD themselves when they are exposed to trauma. It's not like if we don't see them, they don't exist. If we don't look for them, they don't exist. No, we got to go look at them. People don't come volunteer and say that I'm traumatized and I have nightmares. We got to go. So we need data. We need to know how much people in different groups were impacted, how much healthcare workers were impacted, how much people with less or more economic resources were impacted, those who got the illness and recovered. Right now, we have data on, we have the current data says 250,000 Americans were impacted. I'm sure there's a lot more because we don't test everybody. How does that affect? So first, we need the data to see what is the extent of the emotional damage to people. And then we need the resources to deal with those, because this is not a can that we can keep kicking down the road, because we have tons of data from research that shows if we don't deal with it now, later on in 20 years, we'll have to deal with more cardiovascular illness, more obesity, more mortality, morbidity, diabetes, metabolic syndromes, and anxiety, depression, substance use. So this is something that needs to be quickly, the resources provided to people. And of course, I'm not in a position to talk about, well, it's important for people not to be financially stressed and get their jobs. So that those are like responsibilities of others to take care of, to reduce the stress that would lead to worsened mental health.
Dr. Arash Javanbakht is director of the Stress, Trauma, and Anxiety Research Clinic at Wayne State's Department of Psychiatry. We've also been speaking with Allison Miller, associate professor with the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan. I want to thank you both so much for the work you're doing right now and for your time today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much.